Afternoon, everybody. We're going to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 18, 2019. Let the record reflect the time is 2:12 p.m. Today we have present Senator Reinbold, Senator Machicki, myself, Chair Schauer. We have Senator Coghill that should show up a little bit later. Senator Kawasaki will be absent traveling. I'd like to remind everybody, please turn off or silence your cell phones. We've got Kerry with us today on the Senate records, and we have Taylor.
I got it right.
Taylor with the LIO behind us. Only took the entire session to get that right. We have three items on today's agenda, but we may end up with just one of those, and that's going to be SB 32, Crime Sentencing Mental Illness Evidence. We may, in our second session, this is a long day for us, get to SB 75, Commercial Vehicle Licensing Requirements, and SB 97, Art and Public Buildings Facilities, but likely not due to time. We're going to bring back up the CS for SB 32, Crime Sentencing Mental Illness Evidence. The committee last heard this bill on Tuesday, April 16th, adopted a CS that made technical and conforming changes. That's now our working document. We've since opened and closed public testimony. Just as a reminder, we'll still take written testimony until the bill moves, possibly tonight, and those can be uploaded at senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov, and that will stay on the public record. CS for SB 32 is before us. We have amendments to consider for the bill. I'm going to go ahead and work through it. I'm going to ask Senator, since he's sitting to my left, I'm going to ask Senator Machicki to go ahead and move the first few amendments that come from my office, and then I'm going to go ahead and get the first one. So, Senator Machicki, could you move the first one amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment 131-GS1029/U.4.
Thank you, and I'm going to go ahead and object for purposes of discussion. If I could bring up at this time the Department of Law. Go ahead and take it at ease. Let me know when you got to walk out, and we'll just take it at ease.
Couple minutes.
You got it.
And I should only be on for 10.
And if you could, sir, when you're ready, Rob, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and then walk us through the amendment since we worked with law for the requested change.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law Criminal Division. If I can just have a quick moment.
No worries. When you're ready.
So, Mr. Chairman, Amendment number one deletes reference to Section 43 of the CS of SB 32. So that would be page 28 and 29 of the CS. Section 43 is the provision of law that existed prior to SB 91 that limited the amount of active jail time that could be imposed for simple possession of marijuana. And what that provision did was it was an attempt to codify the longstanding Alaska Supreme Court case Raven, which allows a person to maintain or keep small amounts of personal use marijuana in their home. And that section of the bill was intended to codify that. It didn't do it very well, and given what has happened with recreational marijuana, that section is unneeded. So what you see in amendment number one is just the removal of that provision.
Okay. Everything else on that is just renumbering, correct, all the way through to the end to make it right?
That's correct.
Okay. Going to go ahead and open up the committee members for questions.
What?
Amendment one. U.4, correct. So does anybody have any questions on this one? Good? Okay. Let me get back to my script here. I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection at this time. Does anyone have any further comments? Anyone have any objections to amendment number one? All right, amendment number one passes. I'll call you my vice chairman for today. Could you move amendment number two, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment 231-GS1029/U.3.
Okay, and I'm going to go ahead and object for the purposes of discussion. Rest of the repeat, please.
So, Mr. Chairman, amendment number two relates to changes to section 45, which is page 30 and 31. Section 45 is the what we refer to as a refusal, DUI refusal statute. What you see in amendment number two is it makes changes that would bring the refusal statute in line with the same language that you see in the primary DUI statute, which is in section 44. And by using this, the same language, what we do, what this amendment does is clarifies for practitioners that the intent of the legislature is the same with regard to ensuring that the Department of Corrections DOC commissioner has the authority to place somebody at a CRC, community residential center, or use electronic monitoring at his or her discretion, both for the DUI and the refusal.
Okay. And Senator Ramble.
Okay. Yeah, can you just explain this just a little bit more? I have some concerns, obviously, with electronic monitoring, which we went over. The state has, you know, basically taken over a lot, and there's a lot of private sectors that are no longer doing this. So the state, and there's been lots of concerns about tampering, lots of concerns about GPS monitoring, lots of concerns about them not plugging it in and charging it, and I could go on and on and on. I think a whole hearing we could have on electronic monitoring. And also I have real concerns with community residential centers, just their, you know, where they are placed. I know there was one in our neighborhood, a halfway house, when I grew up, and it was always just known as kind of the sketchy house. So I don't know, maybe there's more to this, and is this just for the DUIs, is that what you said?
Yeah, so through the chair, Senator, this is just for the DUI and the refusal.
Okay, I'm okay with that.
Okay, and since we just lost our third member to vote for our quorum, we're gonna stop and take an at ease. He'll be back in about 10 minutes, so
okay.
We'll pick it up at that point, and we'll continue with the amendments. Start moving. His time is of the essence on this one as far as trying to get through the amendments. We were actually, Jake, can I have my amendment sheet back to Tuggle? Kind of hard to go through it if I don't have it.
We
were on number two, and yes, sir, amendment one, which was basically just a, and I'll just tell you real quick, but it was just deleting a section that we didn't need because they had changed it, so that was good. So we're on number two. Rob was explaining that when we had to take a break for people leaving, so now we've got four of us, and I'll mention it as well on the record that Senator Coghill has now joined us, and like I said, Senator Kawasaki would not be here. So Rob, can you take up, and actually at this point, let's just kind of start over on the discussion just because Senator Coghill has joined us, so we're all here, so let's just start on number two and go back to where we were. And I know Senator Ramble had her question answered. She was happy, but that way Senator Coghill's at least heard it. And then we'll see where we sit when you're ready.
Yes, Chair. So for the record again, Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. So looking towards amendment number two as to what amendment number two does, amendment number two makes changes to section 45 of the CS to SB 32 to make section 45 conform with section 44. Let me explain what that means. So section 44 is the DUI sentencing provision of Title 28, and the changes to SB 32 eliminate the or requires the mandatory minimum 3-day of a DUI to be served at either a CRC or electronic monitoring at the discretion of the Department of Corrections Commissioner. The language of the DUI statute, which is what you see in Section 44, and the language of the refusal statute, which is what you see in Section 45, were somewhat different. So to ensure that the intent of the legislature is clear and that the goal is to return that discretion to the Department of Corrections Commissioner, Amendment number 2 adjusts the refusal statute to have that language to be the same as Section 44, which is the DUI statute.
We had, the other three of us were happy with the explanation. Yeah. There was a couple questions. Just let me know if you have anything good on that one. Okay, and we'll go back to the right for the movement. I will remove my objection at this time for the purpose of explanation. Is there any further comments from the committee? And does anyone have an objection? If not, amendment number 2 moves from committee. And Mr. Vice Chairman, could you make a motion, please, to move amendment number 3?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt amendment number 3, version U.8.
Thank you, and I'll go ahead and object for purpose of explanation. And Rob, same thing as before. Yeah. Take it on, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So amendment number 3 deletes the section of SB 32 that was the proposal to create the new crime of failing to provide a DNA sample upon arrest and make that a Class A misdemeanor. Given the discussion throughout the committee process, the Department of Law actually asked for this amendment to remove that that change, to leave the law as is, as a status quo, and to allow the Department of Law and law enforcement more time to evaluate the need for that and its effectiveness.
Okay. I knew that Senator Reinbold would have a question, so I'm just going to preload it and go, Senator Reinbold.
Yeah, that's very disappointing. I'll be honest with you. You guys have testified over and over what a big tool this is going to be. We got to do things differently. So, so far to date on Senate Bill 32, this is the huge disappointment, and I absolutely will object to this, and I will be voting no.
And, Rob, let's talk about that because we had the discussion the other day going through this. My understanding is that everything that you needed previously as far as the felony type arrest that we would have where DNA would be taken, used in the system, none of that has changed, nor that will not change by this. This is strictly removing what we're getting down to that base level and then the discussion about charging someone who would not otherwise be guilty of a crime being charged with a crime simply for refusing. And that's a part of what we're really just taking out of this. So we're not... My understanding is we're not taking away a tool that you needed to be able to do the things that we're concerned with SB 32 for reducing crime and catching the bad guys.
So through the chair, let me describe that a little bit more. So one of the things that we talked about at length during the committee, and Senator, you mentioned this, is that what you saw in this was an identified gap that law enforcement and the Department of Law had seen in the DUI section. And so under the law currently, and will not change, is that when you're arrested for one of those qualifying offenses, so that'd be a violent misdemeanor, all felonies and felony DUI, you have to submit your DNA upon arrest, and that will be then uploaded to CODIS. If you're convicted of a qualifying offense, your DNA will be obtained and will also be uploaded to CODIS. If you refuse to provide a DNA sample after conviction, it's a Class C felony. There was the lack of the enforcement mechanism for upon arrest. Officers have the ability to obtain the court order, which is what we talked about from one of the, I think, Senator Kalsoff's
question. Which has not changed.
Which has not changed. That would remain a law. Officers can seek that court order to obtain that DNA sample. What this does is there's not that additional enforcement mechanism. And so based on the committee comments that we heard both in this chamber and our sister chamber, we've determined that we need to think about, is there another effective, another way to think about this for it to be the most effective?
And I appreciate that. And I know Senator Rebel and I, we disagree on this one a little bit. I say a little bit, we just disagree in it. Mine's looking at it for more of personal rights perspective, and then not holding this as a hammer or leverage over somebody that otherwise hasn't committed a crime, that just simply has that privacy streak of no. So that's really where this came from. And having a trooper that was working for me as we discussed, he's like, absolutely, it would be something I could use as leverage. And so hearing the discussion as we go through it, I'm in support of this, of trying to strip that section out, knowing that I'm not taking away any of the tools that already exist for law enforcement to use. So that's why I support this amendment. And, of course, this is still with the objection open to more committee discussion or comments. I'll go with Senator Machicki first.
Well, I actually agree with both of you, which is problematic. But
yeah.
I would like the tool to be available, but I was very concerned about it being a crime for someone that may not have, that is innocent until proven guilty. So I think that's the problem. Maybe with some time, I think you talked about that, some time over the interim, we can, or perhaps if you have something in within the next couple of weeks, it might be something we can introduce back into it. But I could see that being an issue for, I think the way I described it is my goal is to spend the rest of my life without law enforcement asking to collect my DNA, right? But there are people that are arrested that are found to be innocent, and I think that's where it makes me uncomfortable in the collection. So hopefully you have some ideas on maybe different ways to deal with it. I'll support this right now, but I would like to see something come back that provides that tool for someone who maybe a little bit more obviously involved in some sort of a crime than others, perhaps.
And I will just add, and that's one of the things that compelled me that I'm okay with the removal of this section, is as they explained, is that if the law enforcement officer or officers suspect there is more going on or this individual person, they have the ability still to seek the court order. And that's why I'm comfortable that if law enforcement thinks they need it, they can still get, we're not preventing that as right. The bottom line. So we're not taking that tool away from them. But I'm still very interested in protecting our constitutional rights, and I just feel like we're on solid ground. Good. Senator Rabel.
Yeah, thanks. And I think, you know, I'm all about protecting people's rights and all that kind of stuff, but when the person, you know, has been accused most likely because of a significant testimony, and it is a crime against the body, you know, the ones we specifically talked about, a crimes against a person, at that point, I think they have violated, you know, likely, and I know it's innocent until proven, I get that, but the fact of the matter is they have likely violated another person's rights, another person's integrity, and another person's, you know, future, and that's why I think a little DNA swab, you know, they're not going around taking it on everybody, but people who've committed a crime against a person, and that's why I think it's just so important. And just hearing some preliminary that the sexual assault crimes are going up in this state, I think we need to do things differently, and that's why you testified to the fact that, yes, it could help us from wrongful conviction, because if the rape kit matches up with a DNA swab, then you're sure that it's the right guy. So I believe, or gal, whoever, but the point of the matter is that it can help prevent a wrongful, you know, so the wrong people don't go to jail. And that's why I think this is so doggone important. And with the state of what we're in right now with the sexual assault, the crimes against a person, and their horrifying statistics, I think we got to do things differently. Very disappointing, so I will maintain.
But just to be clear, Senator Reinbold, all the things that you just illuminated as far as examples, none of those changed. All those crimes against a person, those DNA samples are still there. We're not pulling that out. None of that is taken away.
Through the chair, Senator, I did want to follow that up, and that's correct. We're still going to be seizing that DNA.
Okay.
When somebody's arrested for those offenses, we are still going to be seizing that DNA. What this provision did was, if somebody said, no, I'm not giving you my DNA, could we charge them with a new crime? And that's what the provision initially was designed to do. It would allow us to charge them with a new crime. By removing this amendment, we're not going to be able to do that. We're not going to be able to charge them with a new crime. We still have them for the underlying qualifying crime that we arrested them for. That's not going away. But it's the failure to provide the DNA sample, which will not be a crime.
That's why I want to make it clear, Senator Reinbold, case there's confusion. They're still getting the DNA. All those crimes you mentioned, those still there. That's still there. And the law enforcement officer, if they have suspicion of something else, can still get a court order, even in this case of that particular person, to get the swab. So we're not taking away any of their tools. That's why I want to make that crystal clear for the record. So,
okay, so can I follow up?
Extra court, of
course. Okay, excellent. And thank you. That's actually very helpful. But on here, even it says you know, explain, this is the first time I've seen these amendments. I didn't get them. I don't know why. So this is the very first time. Usually I study them and talk to you guys and have an opportunity. So I am learning as we go today. But it does talk in this on line 21, you know, it talks about a sex offender, a child kidnapper, you know, all these people, you know, you can't, you know, if they refuse to submit a DNA sample, you still wouldn't be able to slap a Class A misdemeanor on even that type of a crime. Is that correct? So
through the chair, Senator, what we're doing by removing section 24 of this bill is we're essentially leaving the law as is. So where you see the bolded provisions is where we would, the changes that we made, and we made those changes, and so by deleting this section, the law is going to remain as is. So it's not going to be part of this bill. So it's still going to remain as a law.
Through the chair?
Mm-hmm.
So basically it says this is about, so we are deleting section 23, lines 6 through 23. Is that correct? Am I reading this properly? Page 13, lines 6 through 23, delete all material?
Through the chair, yes, but we're not repealing 1156-760. So, because this, what the bill did was it amended 1156-760 and amended it as it's where it's bolded. But since we're removing this section, the amendments to 1156-760 will not go into effect, but the statute itself will remain.
Through the chair, one more time, because I'm really trying to wrap my head, just because I normally read and
That's
study amendments very hard
before you
go
there, Laura. Just real quick, we're at 3 o'clock, and normally we would take a break from 3 to 3:30. We're getting behind because of all the stuff. Are you guys okay to keep blitzing? Anything else in the way?
Through the chair, if we could just take like 2 minutes.
We can, but I just want to make sure everybody's okay to keep moving, and
yeah,
for the support staff, are we okay, ladies, to continue? And then for the rest of the folks showing up, did y'all have anything for that half hour? Everybody good to stay? Then we're just going to keep moving, so please continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically, now I'm reading the amendment, I think, more of the way that, so all as we're deleting is really, we're deleting lines 7, 8, 9, 20, 23, and 24 for all practical purposes, the new text.
Through the chair, Senator, that's correct. That's how the ultimate statute will read in the statute book once printed. It will be the former statute because we're not making any changes to that statute.
Okay, so one final, because I think this is much less than what I thought we were doing.
Yep,
so
right.
I'm really happy.
I'm
definitely happy. You know, if it's so through the chair, Rob, and it's nice to see you, actually. I'm glad you're here in person instead of on the phone. But so that you guys still will be able to collect the DNA. The only thing you won't be able to do is slap another misdemeanor A if they refuse. Is that correct?
Chair, Senator, absolutely. That's
okay.
That's what we're doing.
Okay, fantastic. That's super good to know. Through the chair, I still want this tool in the toolbox. I know it can't be all my way. I get it. But I, you know, I really hope that this is revisited because this is something, you know, if we can just prevent a wrongful conviction, I think that's really important. And also just doing something because of you know, I want to do things differently. I don't want to just go back because we had pretty bad crime before SB 91. And so we weren't doing things all right before SB 91. And that's why I'd like to revisit. And if this is a tool, I'll be the first to jump in line to carry it.
As far as I'm concerned, everything's on the table always. And this process is going to continue to morph as we get data. We're not done with this by a long shot.
Okay.
I'm talking about the whole criminal package, so things change. Senator Machicki?
So essentially it's required to give a DNA sample for certain crimes right now, but there's no sanction for refusal, and I don't know that a Class A misdemeanor is going to get that person to give up a sample anyway, right? Typically if you're dealing with that kind of an individual, that may not make a difference to them. Just tell us how it works. You ask for a warrant. If a warrant is provided for the right crimes, you will obtain a sample. And we don't need to go into details on how that's obtained, but I can sort of envision how that works. You're going to get a sample if you receive a warrant. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator, that's correct. We would seek a court order, and then, and that court order is, essentially would allow officers, if absolutely necessary, to use reasonable force to obtain that sample.
So, just to follow that up, this may or may not be an effective tool. That may or may not convince someone that they're going to voluntarily give you a sample. So that's why I was also asking about more effective ways to where it might actually be a motivator for not having to wait for a warrant. But you're probably talking about a couple hour process. You've got this person in custody, and it may just happen a little later in the afternoon. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct. And I think that the comments through the committee is what really has had us start thinking about, is there a different way to motivate or incentivize that person to provide that DNA sample that they're required to do so, as opposed to a new criminal offense.
And as we said as well, this isn't done. This is asking for data, and this is something they're going to look at and think they're going to come back to us at some point, I hope, with information. One more.
I understand where he's coming from, and I think he'll understand where I'm coming from through the chair. But I also can picture in my head, I've done enough ride-alongs to say, we need this sample, or I can charge you with another crime. It's probably a good idea that you do this. And so for three reasons, I like it. One, because it's efficient, so they don't have to go down and get a warrant. I've seen how frustrated cops are having to drop everything they're doing, drive all the way down to that courthouse. Sometimes it's an hour or two away, and wait for, you know, to go in and get a warrant. I also think it can help prevent wrongful convictions. So anyway, that's why I support it. I support the concept, and but I definitely understand what you're saying as well. And so anyway, I'm ready to move on, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Cockhill, do you have comments on this one? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection at this time. Any further comments?
I'm going to object.
You're going to go ahead and object for it? Okay, and well, then you just asked it. So are there any objections? Yes. So we're going to have to take a roll call. When you're ready, ma'am.
Representative Reinbold.
No.
Representative Kawasaki. Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senator Machicki.
Yes.
Chair Schauer.
Yes. So on a vote of 3 yeas, 1 nay, and 1 absent, amendment number 3 passes.
And Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I move that we adopt amendment number 4, which is titled U.7.
And I'm going to go ahead and object for purposes of explanation, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an amendment by both Senator Kawasaki and myself. All this does clarifies that the changes to Title 11 do not apply to the legal marijuana industry or the hemp industry. They're not related, but this amendment clarifies that. We've heard a lot of concern, and I think it's important to clarify the two sections.
Is there anyone that you would like to throw a lifeline to come up with a further explanation?
Certainly.
So, through the chair, to the committee, I apologize. For the record, Robert Henderson, Department of Law. So by including the phrase that's included in number 4, what this does is this would carve out from the drug statutes industrial hemp, recreational marijuana, and then what's currently in the law, 1730, because if for the committee's knowledge, when you read the current drug laws, at the beginning of every drug law it says, with the exception of as outlined in 1730, and that is the pharmaceutical regulation statutes. And so what this would do would be adding to that list industrial hemp and recreational marijuana. So individuals who are engaged in those activities would not be subject to the criminal penalties outlined in Title 1171.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Any objection from the administration?
Question.
No, through the chair, Senator, there's no objection from the administration.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions? Okay, I will remove my objection for purposes of discussion. And are there any further comments or objections to the amendment? Then amendment number four passes. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, we're waiting on something on amendment number five. If we can wait, just to, okay. If you can continue on with number six and come back to five.
We shall pass five for the moment. And could you move amendment number six, Mr. Vice Chair, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number six, which is labeled U.5.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. And if I could, at this time, let's have this conversation with the Department of Law, and I'm probably going to invite up the courts as well to discuss this one. There was quite a bit of debate, and I'm just going to set the stage, and then I'll let the other experts testify. One of our things we were looking at is that when you go back in history all the way to 1981, the question was, you know, what rights essentially would be or ability for people to do things, say like gun ownership, for example, if you go all the way back to involuntary commitment, and was there a way to pull that forward so we were not looking so far back in history and make it better, like a 10-year rolling average or something looking back for somebody that's been clean, done their treatment, et cetera, and what the law was. As we got into the discussion, much more came out of that as far as the whys, the what, how, and the whys. And so what I want to do is bring up the experts from the Department of Law and the courts to discuss how we got there and the discussion around this provision and why it would need to stay as it is, and then we'll talk about what I'm going to do with the amendment. So when you're ready, please.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a couple additional information for the committee. So online, I believe Kathy Monfreda from the Department of Public Safety is available.
She is.
Ms. Monfreda is the director of statewide services, I believe, from the Department of Public Safety. She is the one of the Department of Public Safety's resident experts as to the national incident credit system, and she can speak intelligently as to what that does, why that system is so effective, and how it's utilized by both the Department of Public Safety and by our sister states. And then also, I believe we have Stacey Crayley, who's an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law, who can speak to the mental health commitment process and how that is impacted in this statute. But really, for the committee, what this provision does is I view this as a data sharing provision. In other words, information that is otherwise confidential by the court system, when somebody has been adjudicated mentally incompetent and they are committed to a mental health institution, that information is generally speaking confidential. This amendment allows information going back to 1981 to be transmitted from the court system back to the Department of Public Safety for inclusion into the national database. And what that means is that when somebody has been adjudicated mentally ill for purposes of this statute, it means that they are what we describe as a prohibited person under federal law. As a prohibited person under federal law, they are not allowed to possess a firearm. So it's no different than being a felon. Once you're a felon, you're no longer entitled to possess a firearm, both under federal law and under state law, but for purposes of this conversation, under federal law. A person who's been found mentally incompetent is also a prohibited person for purposes of federal law. This allows, this provision of SB 32 allows the court system to share that data all the way back to 1981.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system. Just for a little bit of background, beginning in October of 2014, the legislature passed a bill requiring the court system to send all of our mental commitment orders of 30 days or 90 days or more, 30 days or more, to the Department of Public Safety for them to enter that into their database, and then it's handled. As Mr. Henderson said, that person would be disqualified from owning a firearm because it would go national. That statute was not retroactive. The court has not released older ones because the statute wasn't retroactive and they're confidential information. What this provision would do is have us go back to 1981 and find any mental commitment orders of 30 days or more and transmit those to the Department of Public Safety. As my fiscal note explains, but maybe people didn't look at that too thoroughly, all of our records in the 80s and 90s were on paper. They are now on microfiche, and they are stored at different locations around the state. This would be a significant lift for the court. The fiscal note shows that it would take probably two project attorneys for a year-long job of going through the 21,500 old probate commitment cases and finding which ones were 30 days or more and transmitting the appropriate ones to DPS. We had a discussion earlier during the break about how many of those might be the 30-day or more commitment orders, and I have a report of what we've been sending since 2015. So in let's see, in 2015 we sent 131, 2016 166, 2017 154, 2018 97, and I don't have the 2019 data. So we're looking at from a low of 97 up to 166 a year. I have no idea if that's true of the 80s, if people were committed easier or more or anything like that. So it is a policy call whether the legislature wants us to do that. Doing it would, as I say, be a significant lift. And that's my read of this provision. The amendment says to do it only back to 2011. If it goes back to 2011, we can do it for free because that's when all courts were on CourtView, and we can pull that as a data field, and it would be done in a matter of a much shorter time. If, however, this amendment is not adopted and we are required to do it back to 1981, I would also seek to have the effective date for that extended, because our estimate is it will take a couple of attorneys about a year to do it, and the current version of SB 32 says by the end of 2019, and that would be quite impossible for the court system to meet that if we have to do it at all, which is if the amendment is not adopted.
Okay, and we're going to continue with the discussion just to let the other experts over there. Catherine, can you hear us?
Yes, sir, I can.
Could you go ahead and put yourself on the record, and if you have some good things to add to the discussion, please go ahead.
For the record, my name is Catherine Monfrida. I'm the director of the Division of Statewide Services for the Department of Public Safety, and we have been receiving, as Ms. Mead indicates, reports on a daily basis of individuals that are committed to 30 or more days of involuntary commitment. We also receive multiple reports on a daily basis of individuals who are found incompetent or in the process of being determined to be competent or incompetent to stand trial for criminal charges. The numbers that Ms. Mead cited are close to what I've received. We enter them into our system for record keeping purposes, and we enter them into the National InstaCheck system so that they're available on a nationwide basis. The federal law requires that is a permanent, as Mr. Henderson indicated, is a permanent prohibitor. There is an ability to be restored, and that requires a judge to make that determination, and that actually is a requirement that we have in our law in order to allow us to put the involuntary commitment information into the NICS indices. The federal government is very interested in having all states submit this information. There's even stronger legislation in the federal level right now that's wanting to tighten up even more the restrictions for handguns. And so has offered quite a bit of grant money to the states in order to accommodate the effort that needs to be done to do this. I was just told today that they're expecting that it's called the NICS Act Improvement Program, grant program will be out next week, and there's $25 million in that for grants for the states. The states are required, the Departments of Public Safety are required to offer the courts an opportunity to apply for those grants as well. And this certainly would be an effort that the grant purposes would cover.
Okay, thank you. And then, Stacy, since you're brought up as well, if you have something you'd like to add, let's go ahead and do that now. Do you hear us okay?
I can, Mr. Chairman, for the record. My name is Stacey Crayley, Chief Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law. I don't really have anything to add to the substance of the amendment. I'm here to answer questions about the mental commitment process, if the committee has any, in terms of how the system works and how that might impact the decision on the amendment.
Okay. So entering into discussion, my intent was to get this on the public record, to talk about it, and then pull it. But I actually, to be quite honest, now I'm a little bit questioning whether I should, and maybe we would want to do this. So we need to have a little more discussion here on this one, because initially I thought this was not going to be workable, but maybe it is. So I'm a bit confused on whether I want to pull this now. So we need to debate this a little further here. Go ahead, Senator Reimbold.
Nancy, through the chair, it sounds like you support this.
Through the chair to Senator Reimbold, we haven't taken a position officially on this amendment. I will say it would be way easier for us to do it from 2011 forward than to go backwards. But it is a policy call. If you want us to go back to 1981, we can do it.
Follow up. Yep. Go ahead.
I mean, would there really be any public health benefit or any benefit to it? Because to me, it doesn't. Maybe I'm just not seeing it, but I don't see that would. I don't see how it helped go all the way back to 81. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Through the chair, that might be a better question for the Department of Law, why they want to go back to 1981, and I believe it has to do with the federal government.
Yep.
Before we go there real quick, just see if Senator Cocco had a question that might align with that, so go ahead.
In the, thank you, Mr. Chairman, in the legal draft note that we got, it hails back to the 1993 Brady Act, which didn't come into effect until 2014. They brought up a protection issue that is an equal protection issue, right? If we mirror that language, would we be traveling along the same journey that the federal government is on that equal protection question?
Through the chair, Senator, if I understand your question is if you mirrored the language as to 1993 as opposed to 81.
Yeah, or the implementation was until 2014. So from 2014 on, that law has been in effect and has had a question about if you're convicted before and what the result is before and after the Brady Act come into effect. They bring up the question on the jeopardy question. However, if we mirrored that language on our reporting system, that goes to 2014 basically. And then I think for us, we're asking from this time forward, is it more appropriate because of the Brady Act implementation?
So through the chair, Senator, so currently under the current law, everything from 2014 forward is already being submitted by the court system. So that is already done. What we're trying to do in SB 32 is actually go back further than 2014. And in part because of how powerful this information is and how dangerous some of these individuals can be. These are individuals that are already prohibited under the law from possessing a firearm. We're not talking about changing legal status. These are prohibited people. And so this is a preventative type law. This law is designed to prevent people who are mentally ill and have been committed as being mentally ill from not possessing those firearms. And that's what we're trying to prevent.
Follow up, Senator Cargill.
So maybe because I was looking at the amendment of 2011, that's the court view date, I guess. And so I was somehow, I thought maybe there was a sync with the federal government. Evidently, that's not true. So then the next question, probably what we should do to follow this up to finance probably, is do a near and far step in. For example, the closer they are to this to the recent history, the more likely we're able to catch people that have a significant challenge in our world. The older it is, the less the challenge. So I would say if we did a step-in process to this, so that the courts could actually perform these things, that you take them in, divide it by three or whatever, and just work your way back, because the closer we have to that cutoff time, the more likely we're going to have real issues. Does that sound appropriate?
Through through the chair, Senator, that sounds reasonable to me, but working with the court system to create an effective date that would be workable and reasonable given their manpower would be appropriate.
Senator Ramble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically I have two questions for Mr. Henderson. One, do you support this amendment, yes or no?
So through the chair, Senator, it's the administration's position that this should be retroactive to the 1981, which is the date in the mental health, mental commitment process that was enacted by Alaska statute.
Okay. And
second.
Second question is, and this may be Nancy, I'm not sure, but why does it have to be a lawyer? Why can't it be like a clerk?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, I think you're referring to who has to pull the files and figure out what went on. It can't be a clerk because we pulled a couple of those files as sample files, and back in the 1980s, it requires some deciphering of exactly what happened in a case. Somebody has to figure out what the statutes looked like and how they changed through the period so that we don't have a clerk pull what looks like a mental commitment order, but maybe at that time it was for 15 days, or maybe it was for 3 days. There also has to be some assurance that due process was afforded in the case. Somebody's going to have to go through the file and say, okay, was there an attorney for the respondent, and was there a hearing before this happened? So it does take some analysis.
Third, go ahead.
Sorry, I only thought I had second until she said that, because now I want to bounce back to Rob. Rob, is it worth all this effort? Because it sure, if it's valuable information, it's going to help. We've got a lot of mental illness in this state. If it's going to help prevent, you know, the zookeeper or whatever, you know, just if it's that valuable, I mean, then it's what you're going to say is you're going to sway me one way or another on this amendment is what I'm going to say.
Through the chair, Senator, you know, this is the balancing that we know that this would be an effective tool in keeping firearms out of certain individuals that shouldn't have firearms. We've made that as a large societal decision. We've made a decision that these people shouldn't have firearms. And I think there are circumstances throughout recent past that have shown the effectiveness of some of these laws. And so by making sure that the people who are already prohibited don't have access to new firearms, that's what this is designed to do.
Before we get to that one, these are all for 30-plus day commitments, right? That's on the record, what happens less than 30 days they're committed?
To the chair, the other type of mental commitment that is much more commonly ordered is a three-day, what we call a three-day hospitalization. We don't send those orders to DPS, and the people who have three-day hospitalizations don't have restrictions on their firearm.
Okay, so
purchases.
Anybody less than 30 days, this does not apply to. It's only 30 or more inside an institution.
Okay. That's correct.
And to follow up on what Senator Coghill said, in that category, the farther back we go, and I'm asking because I don't have the data, and we didn't even think to ask where we would get it from. As you go back to 2000, 1990, 1981, is it statistically the farther back you go, would we be able to find that data that somebody is less likely to commit a crime as they go further back? You know, because I said the ones that have problems recent, they got issues, they do the thing. But my point being is if they've been clean for 40 years and no issues and they did their treatment, that's where we kind of started this question from. And I thought I was going to pull it after the public record, but now I'm starting to go, well, maybe do we want to, and then a step into this based on numbers and fiscal notes and everything else. So now I'm kind of starting to weigh this a little bit. This is actually getting a little bit more maybe complicated than I thought it might be for a very simple amendment to discuss it. Whoever wants to try to take that one.
So,
I'll go with you.
So, I don't know what the question is.
Mr. Chair, I would ask a similar question to both Ms. Crayley and Ms. Monfredi online. I don't know if we have those statistics available. I don't have them available right now, and I don't know if those type of statistics are available, but I would be hopeful that Ms. Crayley or Ms. Monfredi would be able to provide some insight in that as well.
Nancy, looks like you want to say
To the chair, I'm not sure I can really add or respond to that question. I mean, I will say that from 24, someone who was mentally committed in 2014 is disqualified now from firing, from from purchasing firearms. I guess you're saying if they were mentally committed in 2000, are they can one conclude that they still need to be disqualified from buying the firearms? Are they still a threat? And that is a call that I don't think we have the data for. That'd be up to you to decide.
And is there a step there with federal law versus state law and the supremacy? Would we be under that anyways? Would it even matter?
Through the chair, if somebody was mentally committed in 2000, they legally cannot buy a firearm. The question that we're talking about here is, will the federal firearm licensee have access to check to see?
Because it goes through NICS.
Yeah,
right?
Through NICS.
Yeah.
Will they be able to check and see if that person is a prohibited person? That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the legal status of any one individual.
And so they don't step on each other. Catherine, I'm going to ask Catherine and Stacey in order. Just Catherine, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, this for the record, this is Catherine Monfreda. I would just add that this keeping guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them, particularly mentally ill people, will also help reduce the number of suicides. And I also have a case that as an example of what's a little frustrating to me personally, of a Supreme Court case that I received a copy of on a matter of a hospitalization of a man who was threatening to systematically kill everybody in his village. And he was the case was upheld. An involuntary commitment was upheld. But because they use a pseudonym in these cases, we don't know who this person was. And it's from a 2013 case. And this person's record is not in the NICS index as far as I know.
Okay, and thank you. And then Stacey?
For the record, this is Stacey Crayley with the Department of Law. I don't have access to any of the data points that you're requesting, Mr. Chairman, so I'm afraid I can't add anything to the discussion.
Okay, thanks. So far, you've been the one of the four getting off easy today.
Very much so.
What I'm maybe hearing, but I'm going to ask for some back and forth on this, is that the data has good use, contributes to public safety, but the courts maybe can't get there within the time frame. So do we need to look at maybe stepping this into some time frame that they can get to? Is that really what is that kind of where this is headed? That's what I'm kind of sensing from this, that we do need to change the number maybe and then look in the future of how we would do that or even put in multiple numbers and give you X amount of time.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sam Machicki did.
Before you go there, we have a limited amount of cash in our checkbook. And just on a cost-benefit analysis, what would be the cost and what is the ultimate benefit? How many cases are we talking about? Is it worth chasing this down to 81? This Department of Law, I'd probably...
So, through the chair, Senator, we don't know how many cases there are, and that's mm-hmm. part of the issue. But I will tell you that I think we are in a very unique spot right now nationally because this is one of the priorities of the current administration, and this is one of the main priorities of the Department of Justice. And so there, as Ms. Monfredi described, there are federal grant dollars available right now that may not be there in the future. So I think this is one of those times where we may be eligible to seek grant funding to help with this project.
Do we know if we can do that yet? And then how much we can get? Is it 50 states, $500,000 each? Or does anybody have any idea on this before we sign up to something that we're going to have a hard time paying for?
Do we have that information? Yeah.
Want to slide over for a second? Okay. Or just bring up third chair, whatever.
This is Kathy Monfreda.
Go ahead, Catherine.
I think I could answer that.
Go ahead.
Okay. For the record, it's Kathy Monfreda, Public Safety. There's been $25 million in the NARIP grant every year for the last probably 4 years now. There's going to be $25 million in it for this year. There are specific, like I explained earlier, you have to have a law that allows for a restoration of rights. In the law, not every state has that, so those states are not eligible for the grant funds, and the federal government has not been able to issue the entire 25 million dollars in grant funds to the eligible states. So we can ask for what it will cost, and it's a really good chance that we'll get it.
And we have that. I see you're shaking your head saying that we do have that. You can put yourself on the record and just say yes, because I get in trouble for head shakes if I let them go by.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. And I did just want to say, Ms. Monfreda, or Director Monfreda, as well as Mr. Henderson had referenced the federal grant funds. Those federal grant funds were the result of the NICS Records Improvement Act, which was enacted as a result of the Virginia Tech shooting. The individual who committed that crime had a prohibitive mental health history and purchased his firearm through a federally licensed dealer. His prohibitive mental health records were not in the NICS database, and had they been in the NICS database, he would not have been able to purchase the firearm that he did.
Okay, I see the connection there. Are we set, just for the record, are we set up with those things that are required so we can actually apply for the grant? Everything's in place to be able to do this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and the Department of Public Safety has received funds through the NICS Records Improvement Act grant already.
That goes back to Senator Machicki. Does that answer your question on where we would stand with this?
Well, I have one more follow-up.
Go ahead.
That helps me understand it. You may have answered it earlier. I was looking at the next amendment, or my past amendment, frankly. Can you do it? What do you hire a contractor, contract attorney? Funds are available. Doable?
Through the chair to Senator Machicki, we can do it. And incidentally, I misspoke or misheard in response to the Senator Reinbold's question before. Our fiscal note does show that it would be 14-8, range 14-8 project employees, and we aren't seeking attorneys to do it. We would need 14-A's, so I was misremembering, because we do need somebody with the ability to discern certain things from the files. So our fiscal note, to go back to 1981, is for $140,400. I will say that we would be reluctant to pull a fiscal note on the promise of a federal grant. And so that would be a difficult step for us to take.
Senator Rebel?
So I'm probably going to lean to your initial instinct of pulling the amendment, obviously, with this excellent discussion that we've just had. But I'm also into big-time efficiencies, if we can, because still $140,000 is $140,000, even if it's from the federal government, which is great, and I'm glad it's a lower range, so thank you for clarifying that. But if there's anything we can do to make it more efficient, if there's any digitized records, you know, where they can, I know Fish and Game implemented, where they have a computer system that you can look for one word in everybody's email, you know, just something that would help, you know, look for those keywords that you're looking for commitment of over 30 days, if they are digitized. They may not be. Second, if we can go to hospitals, you know, local, like I don't think we have all that many mental health hospitals in Alaska. You know, if there's any way, you know, anything court ordered, if they're legally allowed to provide that information. You know, I'm just looking for efficiencies in regards to that. But in the big picture, I think this is a really good idea, because it helps protect law-abiding, non-mentally ill patients from keeping, you know, their gun. You know, it allows them to keep their guns, because a lot of people, well, based on this, that, and the other, they want to take our guns away, you know, and that's what's difficult. And that's why I think in the big picture that I support this, because I don't want guns to get in the wrong. You know, we dealt with this on House Bill 75 the entire session almost last time.
Senator Coghill?
Yeah, I'm okay with what the court said. In data analytics, though, it's a two-sided blade. Just remember. So when we get into this, if we can keep focused on the bad guys, that's good. But when it gets misused, it's really bad. So just for what it's worth.
So I'm going to briefly here for a moment take an at ease to stay, because I want to have just a free discussion for a moment. Director of State Affairs, we just briefly wanted to make sure everybody was kind of in agreement after that very good discussion, exactly what I was hoping to see, to get this on the record. We're going to go ahead and pull the amendment, so I'm going to remove my objection at this time. And
Mr. Vice Chairman, I'll withdraw my motion to amend to bring in amendment number 6.
Thank you very much. Are you ready to go back to yours? You want to continue?
We can go back to mine.
Okay. Let's. Can we go back to? I believe it is 5, Mr. Vice Chairman. Please make motion on amendment 5. Thank you, Nancy.
Mr. Chairman, I move that I move amendment number 5, which is labeled U.9.
And I will object for the purposes of discussion. Senator Machiki.
So this may be a hot topic, Mr. Chairman. What this, my goal in this amendment is to have the discussion about either returning to may arrest or moving forward to a must arrest for someone driving without a license. So currently in the law, when a peace officer stops or contacts a person for commission of an infraction or a violation, the officer shall issue a citation instead of taking the person before a judge or magistrate under AS.25.150, except the officer may arrest if. This is thinking about going to must arrest for not having a license. We tried to separate a revoke from a suspended or just not having a license. I think there are some perhaps constitutional issues with that. This discussion right now is a shall arrest if the crime for which a person is contacted is one involving driving while a license is canceled, suspended, revoked, or in violation of a limitation as provided under AS 2815-291. And happy to have law come up and discuss this. May have to make a conceptual amendment as law discusses this amendment.
Before you want to let him explain it first and hold on to it. When you're ready, sir.
Thank you. For the record, Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. So, through the chair, Senator Machiki, your question as to amendment number 5 and the change to how that would impact changing it back to a shall arrest for a driver with license suspended, revoked. There's really two aspects of amendment number 5. There's the substantive change to the law of driving with license revoked, and then the arrest statute. I am frankly not the best person to describe the impact of a mandatory arrest would have on law enforcement. I believe there's law enforcement on them. Mm-hmm. I think there's DPS online that it would be better suited to describe the day-to-day impacts that they would face if they were required to arrest for driving license suspended.
Which one would that be of the three we have online, you think?
Well, I have a question first, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Go ahead. That's fine.
And,
yep.
And that is, law doesn't believe that Section 36 is necessary. Could you talk about that?
So, yes. Yeah, so, through the chair, Senator Machiki, 36 is unnecessary because it would be the decision of whether or not to arrest really should be left to the discretion of the officer at the time. And so by the subsection, so page 2 of the amendment, page 2, lines 1 through 3, that's where you see the mandatory arrest. And that's where we have concerns about the impact that would have on the day-to-day operations of law enforcement. The changes to the substantive law of driving with license suspended, I can speak to as well if you'd like.
Okay.
Oh, of course, yeah. Before we go to the question.
Okay. So really what you see in amendment number 5, the insertion of new section 45 is changing driving with license suspended to a Class A misdemeanor, back to a Class A misdemeanor, and making a 10-day mandatory minimum. So a little bit of background is necessary to understand that. So under SB 91, one of the things that happened was that driving with license suspended, canceled or revoked, went from a Class A misdemeanor to a violation if it was based on an administrative revocation, and it remained a Class A misdemeanor if it was based on a DUI revocation. So we broke those out. What you see in amendment number 5 is the intent to revert back to a Class A misdemeanor for driving license suspended, regardless of the underlying premise of that revocation, whether that be for points, administrative, or something else. And so, in addition, it creates the not less than 10 days with 10 days suspended for the first offense and a mandatory minimum of 10 days for second offense. If the committee were to move forward with making driving license suspended a Class A misdemeanor, additional changes to 2815-291 would need to occur, because one of the things that you saw in 28, my friend here from the court system, and as Ms. Mead and I were talking, you want to explain it?
I didn't.
To the chair, we had a slight agreement that I would take this if it came up, and that is the changes that you see in Section 45, page 2 of the amendment, are your policy call, whether you want to make all driving with license suspended back into a Class A misdemeanor. But the only thing I think Mr. Henderson was about to point out is if that is to happen, you would want to make changes to 2815-291A, because that's the section that splits apart driving with license suspended and says if it's a based on a DUI, you're going to get certain treatment. It'll be an A misdemeanor. But if your license was revoked or suspended for any other reason, one could be points, one could be failure to pay child support, one could be owing a civil judgment. There are about 10 different reasons that driver's license can be suspended or revoked. So SB 91 said we're going to leave it as an A for DUI folks, but we're going to make it an infraction for anybody else. If they're all made into A's, you will need some drafting changes, and I believe we talked to the drafter. You might have it in your hand to ensure that the statute as a whole reads appropriately.
If I could just add, I remember the discussion. Part of it is on a DUI revocation, you are very well aware that you're driving without a license. A revoked license because of child support, you may not know until you actually get stopped by a police officer, because the notification may not have caught up with you at that point. So there's that question of the culpability, the knowledge of the revocation at the level. And we figured at that point the discussion was a fine was better at that point than an arrest, where if you're doing it knowingly, then the arrest was totally appropriate. So those are the kind of questions that came up over that, because the disconnect between what the courts do and what the administrative result is the same as a revoked license, but the knowledge of it and the impact of it are very, very different. So that's why it ended up that way. And in fact, I was going to start asking that question. If a mandatory arrest, you might want to separate it out, but the question already came up. So thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead. Let Sam ramble. She had a question for a while.
Well, I just, if you don't mind, I've been working on this issue as well. Is this the main issue from the will and our friend?
It's the main issue from subject of many crime meetings I've had, but it happens to be what the Madisons are worried about as well. But I'm kind of more worried about law enforcement's take on it than, you know.
Okay. So basically, through the chair, yeah, this is something that keeps coming up over and over and over again in law enforcement meetings, and one in particular family case continued that we were mutual friends mm-hmm. for a long period of time, all the way back to high school teacher. But this is a really, 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 really important issue that law enforcement has brought in multiple communities forth, and so I'm super, super happy because I had an amendment similar to this, and we decided that he was going to be the one that, and I'm really thankful. I just really want to say thank you, because this has been a really tough one to wrap our heads around. But I think if we could take the discussion back to where I think you were starting, it was page 2, line 1, the shall arrest. Is that the key? I'm just trying to get refocused where we originally started the conversation.
Well, but the reason I wanted to go is I wanted to clarify kind of what the intent was for me.
I was going to ask you that, so please do.
If I may, and then we can continue the conversation. The violation isn't working, and people just drive, and they get violations, and they drive again, and they don't care that they get violations. So I'm looking for a way to separate folks that perhaps – may have had their license canceled or revoked for some particular reason that may not be related to driving, and the others. And it's been difficult getting a clean way to do that from folks, and I've heard there's constitutional challenges. And you know what? The important thing is that the ones that shouldn't be driving, that are putting families at risk and perhaps carrying out other crimes, are no longer able to drive, and that they take it very seriously, because they're not. It's become a joke. So that's what the conversation's about. Senator Reibold is the best way to separate the two, without missing too many, defaulting to the weaker selection.
So,
Senator Cochran?
So what I understand is, at this point, what you think is, the best thing to do is just take them off the road, because we're not going to get any payment out of them. And then there are people who have driven with several infractions, and at that point, just got to get them off the road. And so otherwise, they are a public safety problem all along the way. So the shall arrest probably will need a qualifier to that, because maybe there's multiple infractions or something like that. I get the point. Because without arresting, chances are they're going to be back on the road. And that's the point, if I understand correctly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can I get, I've got Cornelius Sims on the line from the troopers. If you're there and hear us, could you weigh in on this a little bit, if you have something to add?
Yes, if I may. Good afternoon, committee, and thank you. For the record, Lieutenant Cornelius Sims with the Alaska State Troopers. We would like to see, I guess, the change, it just be changed to May, which would allow for officer discretion. Should the officer run across some of the things that the committee has pointed out with multiple offenses and their driving record and everything else, that the totality of the circumstances, then they can make that decision on the arrest versus an example of someone who doesn't, is not aware that their license has been canceled or suspended. And they're stopped by law enforcement. This can also have a potential burden on resources for law enforcement. Give the example of a officer in a remote post or out on the road system, remote area, stops a individual with their family in the car, we'll say a parent with a car full of kids. Now, if we're going to a mandatory arrest, now we're taking that parent, we have those kids, we still have to figure out how to help them and the vehicle, versus if we can get, issue them a criminal citation to respond to court in a situation like that, and get someone else to come drive the vehicle and drive them away so they can continue to take care of their family, versus the one that has multiple offenses of DWLR, driving while license revoked, suspended, canceled, whichever one it may be, then the officer would have the discretion to go ahead and place them under arrest.
Cornelius, let me ask you a question here. So I'm playing a bit of devil's advocate on this one. So troopers are busy. Everybody knows it. I just talked to a trooper friend a couple days ago, and he gave me some data. He's like, he had 48 calls and 32 hours of shift work or something. I mean, he couldn't even get to them all. I mean, he was just like run from one to the next over his entire shifts. And so knowing that you're burdened and that you're spread thin, how would you get to the point where troopers are not going to blow off? And that's why I said I'm playing devil's advocate, blow that off, because they've got so many more important things going on that they get to the point of the guy, I ain't got time for that, and they just keep moving through. Is there a way to get to the intent of the bill, of the amendment sponsor, that we are taking these people off the streets and ensuring that there is some consequence for your action, but still works, that doesn't overly burden the troopers? Because there's obviously there could be a balance here, but just allowing that at times, as busy as you guys are, it's hard to believe that troopers out in the middle of the bush and everywhere else where they're doing things can just slip. I shouldn't say the bush for the road system, but on the road system, that they've just got time for this. So any thoughts there?
Yes.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Sorry.
Through the chair, I would say that in situations like I have faced in the past with situations such as this, those with and I can't obviously speak for every trooper, but it would be of my thought and opinion with that, if this was kind of put back to the way it was before the law was changed, officers were taking that opportunity, were taking those that had those multiple or serious offenses, so I would say, I guess, DWLR is DWLR, but the multiple DWLR offenses were, you know, you realize that that person needs to go to jail. They need to be brought off the road. They're not learning from the citation that they received in a prior time going to court that at this point they do need to be taken off the road and go before the court in that situation. I would believe that officers would understand by just putting it back in their may and giving them the discretion that they would see the importance and that the body has found that, hey, this is important, that, you know, we're putting it back or making a law, opening it back up, that it is important, but we want you to use your discretion. And I would like to believe that many of them would use that discretion correctly, even though we do get busy, because I've been in the same boat where it's call to call to call, and then you run across a DWLR who's third or fourth time, well, things are going to have to stop so I can take them to jail, and I'll pick up from wherever I left off prior to stopping them.
I know. Thank you, Cornelius, and I did. I put you on the spot there a bit for that one. I'm just looking for solutions, so I'm going to go back, I think, one of you. Yeah. Senator Machicki.
Yeah. Mr. Sims, don't you have the right to do that today? And it's not being used. Isn't that correct? You have a right to arrest. You may arrest if you reasonably believe the person is a danger to others, but that's been tough to get to because just having a suspended or revoked license isn't enough. Also, if they probable cause to believe the person committed a crime involving domestic violence, and we have these strange carve-outs, but you really don't have the right to arrest someone that you may have seen. Essentially, what you said a moment ago is if you're driving with a revoked license once in a while, it's sort of okay. And I don't think it is. And it doesn't matter what reason it's for. So we have to somehow separate the fact that it's not okay, even if you just sort of didn't notice your license is revoked, versus knowing you have a license is revoked. And I don't know if you've ever pulled anyone over that just says, gee, officer, I know my license is revoked, but I... you know, that's just not going to happen, just like there's not a single person in the penitentiary that's guilty. So how do I give you a tool when you know that person shouldn't be driving and they're a risk to others that doesn't really fit into what's under 1225-180 right now? And maybe you're not the right person to answer. I don't know. But that's really the question.
Through the chair, speaking from prior experiences, if someone has a revoked license, it gets put into a system. We're advised and basically through the DMV system that, hey, this person's license is revoked and we can talk to them. I will say I have had people that I stop and they say, yeah, I know my license is suspended or officer, my license is revoked. Well, yes, you knew, and me personally, many of those folks have gone to jail because they showed the knowledge that they knew they were breaking the law and they were willingly doing it. And so that's how I guess that has played out for myself personally in the past. I also believe that with the change it was talked about earlier and they were talking about, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact lines it was that would need to be changed to differentiate between the sentencing and the different that when it becomes more of an infraction, and when that got added in, I think is where we start to see less arrests being made versus when it was before what we had before in the law of kind of what we're talking about here, except that it didn't say shall, it was may arrest and had the officers had their discretion.
So I think the line you're talking about is under B, when an officer stops or contacts a person for the commission of an infraction or a violation, the officer shall issue a citation instead of taking the person before a judge. Is that perhaps the line? And I'm playing a lawyer on TV right now, which I shouldn't be doing. But Let me ask this question. Just listening to you, Mr. Sims, and it'd be nice to hear from others. I've heard from a lot of law enforcement that this is a problem for them. So are you saying that perhaps looking at the amendment, if number two simply said, if we left section 30, the changes to section 36 in place, and just change the word shall to may in the amendment, that would sort of take care of the issue, and then leave page the other 20 differences in the on page 29 there as well.
Yes, through the chair. Yes, that's what I'm saying. The change would be the shall to may.
Senator Ramble.
Okay, so now, you know, I understand that I brought us back to this discussion. I understand what he had to say, but the reason why now I am, because of what Coghill said as well, I wouldn't support that. And this is the reasons. One, because it helps make officers accountable, that they will arrest somebody if they're in, you know, canceled, suspended, revoked, violation of a limitation. That's a serious. Just making it a little money thing where they can throw a little, violation or make some money off it. I'm sick of that, to be honest with you. Number two, thrill seekers. You know, some people can go and do thrill seekers, you know, that kind of are just going and driving the cars, and it's exciting to do, just, you know, if they're on a crime and they don't have their license, sometimes they're just, oh, I'm just going to get away with it one more time. I think that it's really super important to know that there could be the threat of arrest out there, because I know somebody in my very recent history that was, you know, had a felony DUI, had so many fines, they're not paying their fines, and, you know, they just kept partying and kept getting in cars and going off. And, I mean, it was just a defiant attitude. They're putting people's lives in danger, all of our lives in danger. And then recently I've been in two accidents in Juneau. Neither one was my fault. And the officer, I think, had very poor judgment in both cases. And I'll give you an example. The gal was speeding right here, right down on Egan Drive. She didn't have title to the car. She knew that she had children in the car. She knew that the brakes were bad. She did not have title, like I said, to the car. And she totaled my car. And it was like, it was just right out. She was just barreling into my car. The cops, I said, we waited, got it all. It's actually on my birthday. It really ticked me off. But anyway, the thing is that the officer used horrible judgment. It was absolutely horrible judgment. I said, listen, she's got kids in the car. She doesn't have title to this car. Her brakes are bad, and she knows it. She's admitted it multiple times. And he said, oh, she needs to go deal with the kids. And he let her get back in the car and drive off with those children after I had been injured and my car had been totaled. And I am tired of bad judgment out there, to be honest with you. 21 people are already killed just with DUI. This did not have to do with DUI. But the big picture is I don't want just a little violation. And I know this is, I think cops need to be held accountable right now and make sure that they do it, not just say, oh, you know, out of convenience for the children or whatever. So that's why I love this amendment. I think this is one of the best things that we've done to the bill, the changes, the amendments that we have had today. And I'm extremely supportive of this with the changes, with the caveats that law and the courts did. And I believe it's in splits apart sections A and B.
Senator Coghill.
So I get why the officers say give us a may, because there's so many different circumstances. And just as a counter to the senator, there are those administrative revocations that do have to deal with driving, and they're usually points-based, right? But there are some that have nothing to do with driving. And so that's what we are trying to separate out is if you have bad credit or you haven't lived up to some things, that has nothing to do with driving. But there are other laws that they're breaking, for example, child support. There are other ways they have to deal with that criminal issue. This was meant to have a punishment to that issue. And we were trying to figure out how do we make them pay for that, because it wasn't a driving infraction necessarily. So that was the reason why. the may probably gets us to some of that discretion. It still gives a Class A misdemeanor under this amendment, which I think is another thing that you're able to say. It goes from a violation to a misdemeanor, and then the potential for jail time does arise. So, and then it connects it with domestic violence, which is a new wrinkle for me, but in your, I think that, isn't that what you do when you say in this subparagraph under domestic violence, you shall arrest or you may arrest?
That's already existing.
It is already existing, okay. I just saw it in bolded language. So maybe Mr. Henderson can tell us what that list of administrative revocations is, because if and I haven't seen it in the statute, maybe you've got it right there.
So through the chair, Senator, I do not have that particular information available to me as I sit here right now. I can get that to the committee. As to the disqualifiers and what operates as an administrative revocation versus a DUI type revocation, because it's more than just DUI. It includes refusal. But one thing I did want to make sure the committee gave some thought to when you're talking about the discretionary provision of the arrest. If the committee were to return all driver license suspended back to the Class A misdemeanor, the message that the legislature is sending to law enforcement is that they need to reprioritize this offense because it was deprioritized when it became a violation. And I believe I've testified in front of this committee before that law enforcement and prosecutors and frankly the judiciary, we follow the priorities of the legislature, and that's where we get that classification is, and that's what we determine as to be more serious than something else or less serious than something else. So the act of returning it to a misdemeanor is sending that message, is highlighting for law enforcement that this is something they need to focus on. It will just be in a different priority as to where it is now.
So question, if we were to allow that choice by an arresting officer for May, does that send the message that we want you to arrest for the non-administrative infractions?
What if we made it so it was shall arrest for the non-admin versus may for the just admin? Now you are splitting them out.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Is that something that is...
Wheels are turning.
I know.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do this today, and I don't like amending on the fly, but I'd like to get it done today. I think where it goes from here, it just becomes more difficult, and I think it's the right message. If you had a may for the others, this question for you, if you had a may for the others, would it still be a Class A misdemeanor if it was administrative, or is that what you're saying? We would break it out. One would be a Class A misdemeanor, one would not.
So through the chair, Senator, I think there's really two issues. One is the Class A misdemeanor portion. Do you want all driving license suspended to be a Class A misdemeanor or not, as opposed to what the law currently is just for DUIs? Because as the senator was saying, that you know there are other reasons, points, and whatnot that you lose your license, but it's not a criminal offense; it's just a traffic violation. The first question is that. The second question is: do you want it to be a mandatory or discretionary arrest, or do you want to have two types of arrests for driving license suspended? So the way I think about this is, if it's a driving license suspended for a DUI, then that should be a mandatory arrest. That's one way to do that. And then if you left the violation, the driver license revoked because of a administrative revocation as a violation, then that would not require any change.
But if, Senator Cogger. But what I hear is on that particular issue, they would like to see the discretion to make it a beyond a violation to ramp it up to a misdemeanor. And that wouldn't require that would require a change. So this section B wouldn't do that. This was only the 291B is just under the DUI laws, right?
So Through the chair, Senator, that's correct. 291 is the motor vehicle licensing provisions. And so I think the answer to the second question, or the 291 question, the Class A Mr. Universe violation, I think the answer to that question, the policy decision that the legislature makes, or this committee makes, actually then drives that arrest question. So I think you have to flip them and answer them separately.
So is there a way to pull this off today with what we have in front of us, or is that going to take more time because I want to get it right? Can we take an idea?
What we can do, I think, Mr. Chairman, I know it's inartful, but if we just took on page 2, line 1, and turned the shall to may, what you've done is you've required an action. You've made it a misdemeanor, and you've required it under an arrest provision that, once again, may. So you have two mays under here under two different conditions, if I understand correctly. But you're actually giving direction on arresting a person involved in driving without a license, basically. So you're making it very, very clear. And you've upped it to from a violation to a misdemeanor in Section 2. So at least this amendment, if you did that to it, would move forward with that policy call. Because you have two sections, one dealing with when a police officer stops or contacts. The may arrest is in Section A and starts with line 1. But the only provision under that was the shall arrest if. And so on page 2, line 1, if you just put arrest in there, it would still may arrest if the crime for which the person is contacted is one. So, I mean, it would fit under that section fairly smoothly. So I'm just saying, if you want to move it forward with the arrest provision and the misdemeanor over the violation, this amendment would get you there, and then you could have further discussions along the way on how to deal with. It looks to me like this would be dealing with both administrative and DUIs. You would have an arrest provision there. That's the way I understand it. It's just that because the arrest is mentioned in Section A, and it talks with all suspended, canceled, or revoked licenses. So you're going to have a couple of – you'll have a tension in one section of the law, basically, if I understand Mr. Henderson correctly, and that is the violation provision under the administrative section.
Let's take an IDs. John, we'll take an IDs for a minute, just kind of powwow, because this is getting back to these on the fly. back on the record. Just for the record, with everybody watching, as we're going through it, we're trying to discuss changes to the amendments. We were waiting on some late paperwork. We have it. So we have a plan. We're going to get back on track. So let's go to the first part. We're going to stop with Amendment Number 5 and withdraw it.
So, Mr. Chairman, I will withdraw Amendment Number 5, labeled U.N.
Any objections? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 5 is withdrawn. And would you move Amendment Number 8, Vice Chair, please?
Same subject, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment Number 8, which is labeled U.14, which deals with the same topic of license revocation.
And I'm going to object for purposes of discussion to get back to where we were. Senator Machicki, when you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That discussion was rich with knowledge seeking and discovery. And what we've determined is that the right place to go on this, as soon as
Jake, you need a copy? One more? U14? Senator Reinbold needs it. That's all right.
You should have had a copy.
No one ready to continue?
So I'm this looks a lot like the last, but I will tell you that this has been corrected. What we're going to do is, if we can get this out of the way, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a conceptual amendment to Amendment 8.
Go ahead.
I would like to delete lines, page 1.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
This is a process issue. We have an objection to adopting it at this point.
We need
to withdraw the objection so we can
do that.
Conceptual.
I withdraw my objection. Continue, please. Thank you for the catch.
Do it right.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Now we have the amendment before us, conceptual amendment.
Can you take a brief at ease?
Yep. Back on the record, small tweak. Go ahead.
Yes, conceptual amendment to Amendment Number 8. We are going to remove page 1, line 4, through page 2, line 6. That is the shall arrest piece. We're going to remove the 1 on line 29 after the A on page 2. And the 1 on line 30 after the A on page 2. With those changes, Mr. Chairman, this is not a shall request requirement. We're going back to the may arrest and leaving that up to the discretion of the officer. But what we're doing is we're moving driving without a license from a violation to a misdemeanor, which allows them to arrest. It goes back to a may arrest for that crime. So it's back the way it was before the passage of 91.
Is there any further discussion or comments on the conceptual amendment to Amendment 8 that anyone would like to make? Okay, if there's no further objections, then the conceptual amendment to Amendment Number 8 is adopted. At this time, we're going to take up Amendment Number 8 as amended.
I think I discussed what the amendment does. I'm open to questions. I'd like to hear how public safety feels about that, returning it to their discretion, yet a misdemeanor for driving without a license.
Take it away.
For the record, Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. Senator Machicki, through the chair, the department does agree with this recommendation, giving the troopers as well as all law enforcement the discretion to care for those circumstances where arrest may not be appropriate. Will certainly be a tool that will help them enforce the law and or be able to arrest when the circumstances warrant. So we are supportive of your amendment. Thank you.
Senator Ramble.
And I apologize that I just want to step back and ask, just to make sure we didn't do anything. I don't want to take the teeth out of anything, and I really liked the shall arrest just because of two recent circumstances that I've been in, and the second one I asked if there was going to be a violation after I had significant damage to my car, and the cop said, it's none of your business, please go on your way. So I said, well, how can I prove if whose insurance company it is? So I've had two horrible experiences with cops in Juneau. Neither was my fault, and that's why I kind of want to force the hand, so there's accountability, because I think I'm getting reports constantly in my district of cops not coming to burglaries and stuff, and I don't want to get too far. So I understand you want them to have discretion, but when we removed that, is there anything else that would improve public safety in that section at all?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, I don't believe so. I think returning this section to the way that it was pre-SB 91 will satisfy certainly the concerns of law enforcement of them not being able to arrest when they believed it was appropriate to do so.
Okay, one more through the chair. So, yeah, because I want to make sure with all these problems, so many cops have brought this up where they said because they know they're on a revoked license or whatever, but they couldn't arrest for that, so then they couldn't get to what they saw in the car, like the drugs and all that other kind of stuff. So this will definitely give them a significant tool back. Is that correct?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, yes.
Can I just clarify something that she said there? It's kind of interesting, but if they see things like that, they have probable cause. It wouldn't matter anymore, would it?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer to the Department of Law.
Thought you might.
Question.
So, for the record, Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. Let me start with the basic premise that, when officers make a stop and they're investigating for a driver's license suspended, that's the scope of their investigation. If they see items that would then lead a reasonable person to believe that an additional crime has been or is being committed, say drugs or a gun or something like that, that establishes potential for probable cause to then take further action. That being said, I think it's really important to start from the premise that an officer has to be acting within reasonable police practices to start their investigation. And what that means is that if an officer is investigating a driving license suspended or revoked, that's the scope of that investigation. It's only upon during the processing of that traffic stop or that stop, if other evidence comes forward, then they could expand upon that initial stop. I think that's an important distinction.
It is. I just want to make it clear that if somebody, if they got pulled over and other things are discovered, that takes it to a different level. Something else changes. So that discretion is always there. Nothing we're doing is changing that. So, okay. Senator Machicki?
We should just clarify for the record that is not the intent, that they will use that to look around and try to find something else. The reality of it is this just says that if you're driving with a license canceled, suspended, revoked, or in violation of a limitation, makes it the officer's discretion to arrest, and it is a Class A misdemeanor. What happens after that is circumstantial, and it's just there's no way for us to. This is not about giving them a way to do other stuff, because that would be unconstitutional. But what you talk about now on the, and you said it very well, with reasonable cause today, they can arrest.
Okay. Any further objections or discussion on amendment number 8?
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
You may.
I have perhaps said inappropriate things on the record about how this could be used, and I'm clarifying that is not the intent of this change.
Copy that. Other comments? Senator Ramble?
Well, yeah, I just want to make sure that this does address the intent of what the cops have been saying in Kenai and elsewhere, and so I do want to follow up, because I want to make sure that this matches the intent of the concerns that have been brought up with multiple constituents and the police officer. So I absolutely want this readdressed after this is run by the cops, in particular in Kenai. If it doesn't, because if they need something more, I want to give it to them. I want to give them what they need to stop criminal activity to the best of their ability. But they said that they were absolutely that this whole thing was inhibiting them from taking one more step, and that's why I want to make sure we're giving them a tool to take that next step if we need to.
back on the record. Okay, at that time, I'll just ask it again. Any further comments on the record for amendment number 8? And any further objections? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 8 is adopted. And Senator Coghill, could you please move it number 7 as amended? Thank you. Is moved from committee adopted as amended. Could you please move amendment number 7?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 7, which is labeled U.12.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Amendment number 7, we had a long discussion about this, and I will just basically read through what this does, and here's the intent. Amendment number 7 addresses the LAA alleged legal concerns about terroristic threats. It mitigates the objections that we had as we discussed through the committee that simply communicating a threat could be charged with a Class C felony. It places the safeguards we were asking about, trying to find to put kind of the boundaries on it, by saying a person makes the threat and with reckless disregard that the threat may cause evacuation, serious public inconvenience, public fear, physical injury, et cetera. And you can look at the bill as it goes through. So there was a problem with the word and as we were discussing it, and that's been taken out. And we're also going to have to do a conceptual amendment on this as well, because we have the words you may see on line 9 or emergency protocol. The reasoning for that, I'm just going to go ahead and say it while we're here talking about it, was that if you look at schools and things, they have lockdown procedures, they don't evacuate buildings. So we're trying to make sure we're covering enough with the net, but the net was not cast so wide that we were catching people that we didn't intend to catch. Like we brought up the example of the bar fight, and somebody said, I'm going to kill you, things like that. So we're not taking the inappropriate people on this one. So I'm going to
hang on a second. Go ahead. We have a brief of these.
Yeah, sure. Happy to go either way.
Just do it now.
Okay, go ahead. Please make the.
Mr. Chairman, there is a conceptual amendment that needs to be put into this amendment. So I move conceptual amendment number 1, which would add on page 1, line 9, after evacuation, the words or emergency protocol.
Okay. I'm going to object just for a moment for purpose of discussion. And I've already highlighted that. I'll say it again, that this is just adding the words so that we allow schools and other places that do lockdown procedures versus evacuation, so that the language is correct with how we do business today in a lot of places. So is there any further discussion about the conceptual amendment to Amendment 7? Are there any objections? Seeing and hearing none, the conceptual amendment to Amendment 7 has been adopted.
Brings number 7 back before us, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are, Mr. Chairman, that's thanking myself. Vice Chairman, thank myself. We are back to amendment number 7, and I gave the explanation to why and how we got there, trying not to cast the net too wide, but make it wide enough. So open to the committee for questions, comments at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to get
Senator
this
Ramble.
On the record, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
The and, so it doesn't have to be compounded, is removed. That long discussion, I think it was about an hour discussion, and I just wanted to make sure that that is correct.
Department of Law, go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct. What we've done is we have reformatted and reorganized to avoid that issue that we talked about at the last committee hearing.
Thank you, Rob. Through the Mr. Good. Chairman, thank you.
Okay, Senator Coghill.
No.
Oh, sorry. I thought you had your hand up.
I think it's a good add.
Okay. Is there any further discussion from the committee on Amendment number 7? Are there any objections? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment number 7 is adopted as amended. And at this time, we have no further amendments before us for Senate Bill 32. So that leaves the CS for SB 32 as amended before the committee. And we're at the time of final discussion. The intent of the chair today is to go ahead and move this bill with the amendments. We've had lots of time to move this or to discuss this one, so I think we're getting to a better place on it. And the floor is open for discussion, comments, et cetera. Take your time.
Mr. Chairman, I can't find exactly the 7-day one. My sticky fell off, so I just need a minute.
Go ahead. There may be other.
Rob, do you know where it is?
I've had some comments and things ago.
So, through the chair, Senator, I believe you were talking about Section 12, page 7 of the CS.
Okay. Yep, at the bottom.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ramel, when you're ready.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the little bit of time I needed. So it's page 8, line 8. The owner is deprived of the use of the vehicle for 7 days or more. Can you just explain to me exactly what that means? Because I don't know if it means they can't be charged for, you know, they have to be deprived of that.
So, through the chair, Senator, I just want to make sure that you and I are looking at the same thing. I'm looking at page 7, line 29. Are you looking at a different section? Because I heard page 28.
Through the chair. Are you looking at the... I'm page 8, line 8. Oh, I'm in version U.
That's why.
Sorry.
Just cut it bottom of page 7.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I was using the blue line, red line version. That's just one of my favorite versions, ways to look at the bill. You're absolutely correct. It is in version U. It's page 7, line 29. You're correct, Ms.
So, through the chair, Senator, so what you see in section 12 overall is that is those are amendments we made to the crime of vehicle theft in the first degree. And what you see in subsection A1 and then subsection A2 are two separate ways to that somebody can commit that crime. The first section, subsection A1, is that a person, having no right to do so or any reasonable ground to believe the person has a right, drives, tows away, or takes a car, truck, motorcycle, motorhome, bus, aircraft, or watercraft of another. That's your classic, what I would say is our most common vehicle theft. It's subsection 2. That's a different factual scenario. It's the propelled vehicle of another. So it's a different type of vehicle. And think of ATV, that sort of vehicle. And then one of the ways of taking that action would be that the owner deprives the person of the use of that vehicle for 7 days or more. So it's that elongated deprivation of that property that helps us prove that case. And I'll just, for the record and for the committee's benefit, when you have property that's been deprived for that long length of time, that's how I think about that, is that's prima facie evidence of intent to permanently deprive. It's circumstantial evidence that you intend to steal it.
Senator Ramel.
Okay, so just trying to wrap my head around this, can you just put it in, like, realistic, the first and the second? Just put us in a classic example.
So under subsection A1, the person steals a car out of your driveway without your permission. And then subsection A2C, a person takes your snow machine or your ATV from your cabin and you find it more than 7 days later. And that person had it for more than 7 days. It's another way to prove that element.
Okay, so through the chair.
Senator Ramel.
Thank you. So what I'm trying to get to the bottom of this is time. So if someone steals a car in the first part, mm-hmm. even if it's gone for an hour, yes, you can convict them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Mr. Henderson, if they steal the ATV for an hour, they can be convicted under one as well. However, there's also a second way they can be convicted. If you were gone and you showed up at your cabin and it was gone for 7 days, that's an additional way. Is that correct?
That's correct. So, Senator, and to help understand that, if you look at 2, there's other ways under subsection 2. You damage the property. You damage that vehicle.
Okay. Good with that. Okay. Copy. Senator Machicki.
Why is propelled vehicle not in 1?
So, through the chair, Senator, that's a question that I'd have to go back and actually look at the legislative history for why we pulled out propelled vehicle. I will also tell the committee that, remember, when we're talking about any type of property and you're talking about property that's over the value of $750, even though we have the crime of vehicle theft, we also have the crime of theft in the second degree. You know, recklessly or intentionally taking property of another with intent to permanently deprive. So we have multiple theories, multiple ways of proving that theft.
However, in Alaska, a propelled vehicle, the way I'm understanding it, which would include a snow machine, four-wheeler, six-wheeler, side-by-side, is a primary source of transportation. And if someone steals it for a little while, doesn't damage it, and it doesn't cost you anything while it's gone, it's not essentially a crime other than basic theft. Why is it viewed differently?
So, in through the chair, Senator, in that scenario, when somebody stole, if you were to steal my ATV out of my driveway, we would charge that, even if we caught you immediately down the street, we would charge that assault, theft in the second degree, a Class C felony, the same level of offense that vehicle theft is. And for purposes of sentencing, it doesn't matter if you're convicted of both because they would merge for sentencing purposes. You'd only be convicted of one offense. So we have that tool. We have that ability in the law right now.
And I'm sorry?
Continue.
And vehicle theft is a Class A felony?
Class C.
So has anyone discussed... people perhaps thought about the drug charges being recriminalized was a little tough. I personally don't. I support the changes in 32. But has anyone thought about raising a vehicle theft to a Class B? I mean, it's serious. And if someone steals my vehicle, I'll go rent another one, can still go to work, I can do whatever I need to do until that vehicle's replaced. There are thousands of families in Alaska that are just out of luck. And it's a problem. Did we think about kicking a C felony up to a B in this bill for vehicle theft?
Through the chair, Senator, that precise question was not thought about whether or not we would be more effective to have a higher classification for vehicle theft. Because again, what we're talking about with vehicle theft is the object that you're stealing, and we will always have the higher theft statutes in case if somebody were to steal a very expensive vehicle, those sorts of things. But the short answer to your question is no. That I don't think that precise conversation was good.
One last one. I know I can see her. She's ready. The question I have to ask is: this bill seems sort of fit for purpose for the kinds of crime issues we're seeing in Alaska right now. Yet we are seeing. I saw a thing today that we're somewhere between Seattle and San Francisco for the highest property crime rates in the country. And it wasn't on Facebook. We have this dramatic increase in something, and this bill is here fit for purpose for the types of crime we're seeing. I'm just curious why vehicle theft wasn't considered. And if you do consider that as something perhaps we should think about. I know we're moving the bill out and we're getting close to final, but I just interested.
I'm not sure there's a question there, really. More philosophical, Senator Ramble.
No, there was a question.
Was there a question? Yeah. I'm sorry.
To the chair.
Oh, my. You're right.
Senator, that's something that the administration will absolutely think about and whether or not that's something that should be changed. There's a couple, again, as I've testified about, I want to think about the unintended consequences a little bit, but that's something that we can think about.
Certainly will come up in finance. So,
yes.
Could be added if you believe it's something we could look at. Senator Ramble.
Thanks. I don't get to brag often because I don't usually drop that many bills. But the C felony, first time having the ability to place jail time on a first time C felony was the biggest amendment over there on Senate Bill 54. And so I was really thankful that passed, because that was a huge deal, because it's such a massive issue in our community. But I will tell you, one of the other many, many amendments that I proposed over there was B felony for vehicle theft. And the reason being is because it is true you can charge for a B felony for a car theft if it's over $25,000. Mr. Henderson, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator, that is correct.
Okay, and through the chair... Why I tried to do this, this was an equity thing. Why should someone wealthy that ends up having a vehicle over $25,000 could charge as a B felony, but the average population couldn't. So I did it strictly as an equity thing, and it almost passed over in the House. And yeah, that was about 2 years ago. So yes, it's been thought of, and by God, I would support it. I got the amendment drafted. It'd be super cool to get that through.
I'll have you two work on this to my left because we're going to continue. Senator Coggill was very patient and had some comments. So Senator Coggill, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, because of other duties I've had to come and go, and so probably the only frustration I've had over this is not being able to debate the rewrite of the drug portion of this. And I think going down through that would have been instructive. I know it's politically hot, but it's also an important cadre of when you shift them back the way you have. One of the things I do appreciate about this particular bill is the taking the escalator of the CPI out of the theft provision, which I didn't ever agree with to begin with, but I tend to agree the theft of a vehicle means something different to a rich person than it does to a poor person. There's just no two ways about it. So I appreciate that. I appreciate many of the amendments that we've brought into this bill, trying to get some help to those who have to pick up people and those who have to charge them. But you've heard our frustration. Just because we say it in law doesn't always mean it happens exactly that way. And that is a frustration that we have. I mean, it's just I've felt that part of the rewrite is because of we thought that it would probably land better than it did, and this is also going to have that issue because even though I think on, for example, the methamphetamine part here, we're going to ramp that up pretty significantly. We're probably only 10 years late on that, but it's coming back at us. It's an amazing thing. So those who both use and are distributing that and probably fentanyl. Those two issues caused me to be willing to support this bill because that's something we just didn't get right. We just didn't. I don't know that I totally agree with the total schedule change, but we couldn't debate it. It just the time wouldn't allow it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support moving this along. I will have other comments to those on the Finance Committee. I'm probably the only one that will only get one shot at this, and even at that, I haven't been that active because of other duties. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm ready to move the bill.
Further comments from anyone? Any further objections to moving the bill?
No, I'll just make a quick one. Good work, everybody. We've worked hard on several of these, but this one is a key bill, and I don't know how to say it enough. It's time to get it financed, get it on the floor, and get it across the finish line because we're running out of time. And I think people, everybody, are counting on us on these bills, and we cannot let them down. It's too important. So thanks for all the hard work. I think this one is key. I'm looking forward to the fiscal notes as we wrap up our processing with it. But thanks to all of you out there that have helped us on some of these answers as well.
Senator Ramel.
You know, I can't help it as well. You guys have all been great to work with, including you. Senator Coghill, thank you. It really was a pleasure to work with you on this committee. And I really appreciate your input and your thoughts as well. And I think you run an excellent committee in regards to this bill and many others. And Senator McChicky and I are almost on the same page, it seems like, almost every step of the way. And I will say, as this moves on, this is my only shot on this bill as well because of finance. You know, I'm not on finance, and it got booted out of judiciary. So it certainly didn't move as quickly, but I think we did an excellent job overall in regards because you had a lot of other pressures. We had a lot of other pressures in regards to that. But as it moves to finance, we've got two gentlemen on finance. Please don't ever forget the cost of the people, you know, the $100 million or so that they've estimated. And I will support the fiscal note on this bill. And I'm even though I'm a massive budget cutter in the big picture, this is one I will support because the impacts are, you can't even measure the cost that this is having on society right now. And that's why I just want to make that comment so you know that where my heart's coming from as it moves on into finance. But thank you for a job well done.
Thanks to everybody, actually. So I'll say that because we're all, now everybody's happy we're kumbaya for a minute. At the end of it, everybody's like, oh, thank goodness. So, but for the public, it's important that they know that this is this time to move the bills, and it is. We need to get these across the finish line. There's going to be work with the House, and that's obviously a big point right now as far as what the House is going to do. But certainly I think the Senate and the governor are on board. We're trying to get something done here on this crime issue. So I appreciate everybody's patience. I appreciate your time. State affairs has been a lot of long nights with a lot of public testimony in the evenings and some very long days, not excluding yesterday, which I think I was in the building for 17 and a half hours with all of that stuff. So I just appreciate all of this work this session this year. Because this was probably extraordinarily long compared to some of them with all of the things that were thrown at us. But, yay, this is the last heavy lift for state affairs this year, says it moves out, so just so that you know. And I will be, Senator Coghill will be doing some of this next week for me as I have something to take care of. So, that being said, enough of that. Let's get out of here because it's after 5. Mr. Vice Chairman,
and
please.
Just one other note for following up to finance. I recommend that you take care of that court rule change. I really do believe that's a two-thirds vote, so I think that's something you need to. I move that the Senate State Affairs Committee move CS for Senate Bill number 32, version 31, GS1029U, as amended with individual recommendations, the attached fiscal notes, and authorize legislative legal to make the necessary technical conforming changes, and our individual recommendations with those fiscal notes.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Coghill. Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, CS for SB 32 has moved from committee. We're going to take an addy to sign the paperwork. Actually, you know what? We're just going to go ahead and finish because we'll sign it after we're done. That concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting again Tuesday, April 23rd next week, 2019, at 3:30 p.m. back in this room to get rollout and public testimony for HB 48, temporary state employees and part exempt services, and possibly bring up SB 73, successor of Lieutenant Governor. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect time is 5:04 p.m.